The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives.
I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. In 79 AD, a young man by the name of Marcus Serenius Vatia was running a campaign to be aedile for Pompeii, a Roman magistrate responsible for public buildings, public games, and the supply of grain to the city. We know about Vatia because of a negative campaign run against him by his political opponents. The ads painted on walls and crowded streets about town proclaimed that, quote, the petty thieves support Vatia for aedile, and that, quote, the late night drinkers all ask you to elect Marcus Serenius Vatia. Unfortunately, we will never know if Vatia prevailed or if his opponents were successful. Fast forward to the 1964 presidential election campaign of Lyndon B. Johnson and Barry Goldwater. This campaign featured one of the most famous and effective political ads. Now known as a Daisy Girl ad, it inferred that choosing Goldwater was tantamount to choosing nuclear war and annihilation. Of course, both claims are an exaggeration, if not an outright falsehood. It might seem as if negative ads of yesteryear have given way to disinformation or fake news of today. But disinformation itself is also nothing new. In 1646, the physician and philosopher Thomas Brown published his Pseudodoxia Epidemica. Roughly translated as an epidemic of fake news, it objected to the, quote, vulgar errors and superstitions and charlatans of the age. Disinformation has been around perhaps as long as humans have, for one reason: it works. According to author Yuval Hariri, Homo sapiens are a post-truth species. We are the only mammals that can cooperate with many strangers because only we can construct and spread fictional stories such as religion, sports, or money, and convince millions of others to believe them. Harari also maintains that Homo sapiens prefer power to the truth because power depends on creating and believing those fictional stories. With the advent of the digital age and the internet, disinformation has had an outsized impact. Today, technology enables the construction and spread of fiction on a scale never seen before. Technologies such as AI and machine learning, fed by massive data troves, enable hyper-targeting of vulnerable voters. Echo chambers created by algorithms play on our cognitive frailties and make us more entrenched in our beliefs, even if fictional. And social media platforms supercharge spread. Given how effective disinformation has become, it begs the question, should we now expect it to be a part of everyday political campaigns? And if so, what are the consequences?
Our guest today is Professor Phil Howard. As director of Oxford University's Program on Democracy and Technology, he oversees a large research team working on the use of new information technologies in politics with the aim of raising civic engagement and improving public life around the world. As a scholar of political communication and an authority on global media, he studies elections, conflict, and international affairs, focusing on the relationship between technology and politics. His research currently involves policy analysis and big data research into the information operations targeted at voters and democracy, what he calls computational propaganda. Since 2014, Phil has led the study of misinformation around the world through public writing and lectures, and has advised world governments, the technology industry, and key civil society groups on the best responses to election interference, fake news, and misinformation. He was recently named a global thinker by Foreign Policy, and the National Democratic Institute gave him their Democracy Prize for pioneering the social science of fake news. Because he exposes how dictators and extremists use social media, he and his team have themselves been targeted in information operations. In 2020, Professor Phil Howard published Lie Machines, How to Save Democracy from Troll Armies, Deceitful Robots, Junk News Operations, and Political Operatives, a critically acclaimed book that exposes the upsurge of highly organized campaigns to manipulate voters. It demonstrates how such campaigns are produced and consumed over Facebook, Twitter, and other platforms. He currently chairs the Oxford Commission on AI and Good Governance, which investigates how government agencies should design and use artificial intelligence to improve public life. This Blue Ribbon panel provides concrete action items for putting machine learning into public service with democratic values. Alongside this commission, he is researching the global production and consumption of misinformation about COVID-19. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you for having me on.
So you have coined a term, computational propaganda. What do you mean by that?
Well, computational propaganda is the stuff that hits our inboxes and our news feeds that arrives because somebody has used some sophisticated toolkit to figure out what we're most likely to respond to, what we're most likely to be interested in. And it's often produced by taking data that we ourselves have generated. Right? So it creates this kind of feedback loop that gives us junk.
What are then the most effective tools of computational propaganda?
Well, I think every few years it's changed. When we started doing this research, 2015, 2016, most of the research was about bots, right? Accounts on Twitter that would hit us with tailored messages sometimes, that would choke off conversations around certain hashtags, or that would present the appearance of consensus around some issue where there wasn't actually consensus. And so over time, we've gone from working on Twitter bots to working on much more organic content generation, usually on Instagram or Facebook. Now there's a whole host of hard right websites and social media platforms that generate really nasty content. And so that's where the research action is. I guess the target has shifted every few years. If somebody can do something innovative in this space, they'll try it out. They'll play.
You know that Trump, for example, was kicked off of Twitter and Facebook because of some of the activities. Some argue perhaps albeit too late, but he is now threatening to create his own social media platform. In fact, some of the folks on the right who feel that they have not been heard adequately or that big tech is against them have really championed the idea of creating a whole other social media platforms targeted for the right. What do you think about that? I mean, how would that, if that were to happen, how would it change, number one, the sort of the dialogue? Would it really reinforce the echo chambers? And how would that change your research?
Well, it's there have been a couple of projects like this, especially since Trump left office, alternative social media platforms. There's sort of an alternative to Medium. There's an alternative to YouTube that's for far right extremist content. And I think many of them have collapsed for a couple of reasons. They often start off by saying the mainstream social media platforms are discriminating against conservatives. And so we're going over here. They take the toys, take the content over and try to play by themselves in a new corner. And not that many people follow, or the people who follow are quite far right extremists. They're into conspiracies, sensational content. And the small C sort of regular conservatives aren't interested in that stuff. They're still Republican and they're still conservative, but they're not that far end of the spectrum. And then several of these platforms now have started up with terms of service agreements where they say that they're not going to moderate content, they're not going to regulate content the way the liberal mainstream platforms have discriminated against them. And then those platforms get packed with the most wild and sensational stuff and porn, because if you have no content regulations, if you try to have a completely libertarian space with no norms of conduct for racist or sexist content, then you get that other kind of content too. And so those sites have had to close down. They haven't functioned very well. Some of them have managed to draw in an international audience. There's several that attract the far right in Brazil, across Europe, but they tend to not be very good business models. In fact, not many of these social media platforms are actually good business models, but the new far right ones don't tend to last very long as businesses.
It seems like they are creating echo chambers, right? I mean, it can't possibly all that interesting if the only people there are the people who already agree with you. So I imagine it's not that interesting in that regard, and it's not very successful from the standpoint of creating campaigns and pushing, attracting new followers to the direction you're trying to propose. So I think
your instinct is right. These are not platforms for deliberation. They're not discussing new policy ideas or really debating. It tends to be, but these kinds of platforms are very good for coordinating social movements. So you can, if you know everybody's on the same page, it's much easier to coordinate messaging. And often these platforms, these new far-right extremist platforms, become the launching pads for engaging with more traditional conservatives or mainstream media on the other platforms. So they definitely have a role in this kind of the media ecology of modern life, but it's not, it certainly isn't in deliberation, anything we think of as deliberation, right?
It seems like what you're saying is that they get the most extreme to follow them. And then because there's not this deliberation, because there's not this exchange of ideas, it becomes a coordination point. Perhaps, one of our previous guests had likened this to almost these war games, these virtual reality, physical video games that happen, this game, sort of gaming motif. And that kind of reminds me of what happened in January 6th, where the platforms were really used for coordination of getting people out there for effectively an insurrection.
Yeah, effectively, they are also very good for testing ideas. So you can test your messages. You can try 3 or 4 different crazy stories, see which one gets the most pickup with your audience on the platform, and then that can become that maybe becomes the story or the explanation or the frame that gets exported to other platforms. So they're good. They're good for coordination, and they're good for testing the new headlines.
So who are the entities that are behind these campaigns? Is it, foreign governments trying to shape outcomes of elections? And who's coordinating all the heavy lifting?
So that's a great question, because the answer has also changed over time. I think when we started doing this research, I was living in Budapest in the summer of 2014. And that was the summer when the Malaysian Airlines flight was shot down over Ukraine. And at the time, I watched my Hungarian friends get multiple ridiculous kinds of messaging over Facebook. There was the story that US troops had shot it down. There was a story that Ukrainian democracy advocates had thought Putin was on the plane, flying on a commercial airline, right, from Amsterdam to Malaysia. And the story was that democracy advocates had shot it down. My favorite, far and away, was the story of the lost tank from World War II that came out of the great forests of Ukraine confused and had accidentally shot the plane down. Right? And at that point, I sort of realized that the goal here is not to provide one story that your opponents can respond to or engage with, but the goal is actually to provide multiple conflicting, sometimes equally ridiculous stories, to confuse everyone, to confuse the issues. And what we didn't expect over time is that we knew that these stories had origins with the Russian government, but we didn't expect to see the Russian government go from using this technique of misinformation on its own people to using it against voters in the West. And then again, we didn't expect political figures in the West to start using these techniques on us as well. And so over time, it shifted. It has been a lot about foreign powers meddling in particular elections. It's now pretty mainstream, right? It's mainstream political parties. These aren't lone wolf hackers anymore. These are major communications firms in New York and Toronto and London that offer these toolkits of service, these kinds of services. It's mainstream politicians and mainstream political communication experts that do this stuff. The one One thing that I add to this that's sometimes difficult to hear is that in most countries, it's often domestic white supremacists or domestic particularly macho elected leaders who pick up on extremely sexist content and say things domestically. It's not always foreign governments. We have a tendency to want to, you know, kick the Russian government or blame the Chinese government or something, but often it's our own white supremacists, far right in our own country that generates this stuff now.
Yeah, we had a conversation with Jonathan Ong a while back, and he was describing to us some of the industry, the disinformation industry, particularly, you know, in the Philippines. And that was kind of the point, is that this is an industry now and it's business, right? And so the line, I think, is it fair to say that the line is blurring between traditional marketing techniques and, you know, that which we would like to put a bow around and say, you know, this is disinformation and should be illegal.
Yes, and one of the reasons for that is that we have all democracies, almost by definition, have rules on the books for how to run a clean election, right? That's what makes a democracy strong. You have clear rules, everybody plays by how to run an election. And in most democracies, elections administrators are slightly underfunded or understaffed or don't quite have the ability to issue fines or themselves become the targets of misinformation. And so it's often difficult, you know, at the end of a campaign season, most political parties and politicians are supposed to file reports on how they've been spending their money and who they've hired, but they don't. They're not required to go into a lot of detail. And so we have they issue very large multi-million dollar contracts to large firms, but those large firms hire smaller firms who then hire specialized, you know, really specialized firms that, you know, all this information doesn't get reported up to public agencies. So we don't actually know much about the structure of that industry. All we know is that, we see the outcome, right, domestically in our own public sphere.
You actually put out a report, the Oxford Internet Institute, called Industrialized Disinformation, 2020 Global Inventory of Organized Social Media Manipulation. And what you just said is one of the findings of that report, which said that, yes, you can actually trace some of the money that is spent, but that a large part of it, because it's very hard to trace the total amount of money that is spent. What was some of the more interesting findings or some of the more surprising findings in that report for you?
Well, we started that inventory in 2017, and we started with a couple dozen countries. We're now up to 80. I think perhaps the most important finding we didn't actually write up is that pretty much every country we look at now, we can find some evidence of organized misinformation. And it was so noticeable last year, we were just trying to, you know, get as much global coverage as possible. It was so noticeable last year that we're not sure we're going to do it this year, because the trend line is up, and we went from 30 countries to 80, 82.
It's universal
countries.
Now?
It's effectively a global phenomenon. And it doesn't make sense to do country by country tracking. Now, what's changed over time is that in the early years, it used to be military units that were retasked to doing social media manipulation. And now it's mainstream comms firms. I think in that report, there's a graphic around the middle that shows that in the first year, 2017, less than a third of the incidents were organized by corporate consultants. And now it's more like two-thirds are organized by corporate consultants. So it's become industrial. It's a pay-to-play game at this point.
And where do we go with that? Is it possible to think about a future where you're tracking it country by country because, you know, there is success in curbing it to some degree?
Absolutely. I'm confident that we can be successful in some ways. Part of it has to involve some leadership from the firms themselves, right? So the technology platforms themselves serve up large amounts of disinformation in the 2 or 3 days before voters vote. That's the proximate, most immediate cause of the problem. And get out the vote campaigns, do good diligence with flagging problematic content, enforcing your content norms, your community norms on people who are clearly breaking them. Like that has to happen, especially when in the heat of the moment. It's not clear that the firms even now are doing that. In fact, the most recent whistleblower, right, she basically confirmed that everything we outside researchers had found, they found internally with their own research team, but also did nothing. Right. It's not just that we found these things, they found them themselves. Part of it also has to fall on governments and public agencies, media education, digital literacy for kids, right? So far we've been talking about the elections from the last few years and today's voters, but we don't actually know a lot about how misinformation will impact tomorrow's voters, the people who are growing up, forming their political identity now on Instagram and social media platforms that I don't even use or much less study. There's a whole bunch of things we need to know about how this is going to impact young people, and governments can help lead there too. So I think there are some solutions in the toolkit. We need to test which ones work best and start rolling them out.
You're listening to you talking about how some of the social media leaders, the leaders of some of these corporate entities, don't really seem to care. At least they're certainly taking the money and performing the task. And even with the conversation with Jonathan Ong, he was saying that a lot of the folks who are down in the ditches doing the work are, from an ethical standpoint, really separating themselves and saying, well, I sort of see this as just a job. I'm just a cog in the machine. You can't help but think that maybe we have swung the pendulum. You know, it used to be that at some point, I remember who was the presidential candidate, Gary,
Monkey Business. Yeah.
Yes, who just because he had some woman sitting on his lap, basically you had to bow out of the election. That is absolutely laughable now, because so many other transgressions have taken place. The idea of shame has gone out of politics, right? So you wonder whether are we truly as a society moving towards a place where a sense of shame doesn't no longer drives us, that our ethics are really bound by commercial interests? Or is it that, you know, that's always been part of us, that we just don't have the right incentives? I mean, I guess that's a question for sociologists, but from the research that you're doing, does that sound like a fair conclusion to draw?
Yeah, Alex, I think that's fabulous. I like this idea that social media has taken sucked the shame out of public life, or replaced it with the clickbaity titles and the outrageous photographs and sneaky videos taken through stunts or leaked. That definitely drives traffic, and social media firms want to drive traffic. I don't think it has to be this way. To some degree, the platforms we have right now have not been designed for consensus building, right? They're not designed to build our empathy with people who are suffering or the poor or people who have have different opportunities in life. And they're not designed for consensus or empathy, but you can imagine designing them for consensus and empathy, right? There are examples of websites that do fabulous community building that are able to drive consensus from, you know, people who are very polarized on climate, people who are very polarized on really hot button issues, right? Gun control, abortion. There are ways of dialoguing, meeting with victims, talking about policy options, and arriving at points of consensus. And sometimes I think the solution may be more social media, not less.
Interesting.
It's unlikely.
Maybe more social.
Yeah, more social, with more of that social support and social stigma. One of the problems right now is that we don't know, we aren't confident that everybody is getting the same news content, the same stories. In fact, I think we can be pretty sure they're not. They're getting they're getting wildly, even from the same news organization, different kinds of content will arrive, will get promoted based on where you are physically and what you might have clicked through previously. So that sense of shared experience and shared content, I have a colleague who's very fond of asking if we have a right to the truth. I'm not sure. I think we do, but I don't think we have an infrastructure that can consistently provide access to truths, even if we did want them.
Do you remember Stephen Colbert? He had this term called truthiness.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Something that you want to be true, it really isn't, but because you want it to be true, therefore it is true. I wonder whether you agree with Yuval Harari in his suggestion, or I guess it's not suggestion, this is what he's saying, that humans are a post-truth species. In other words, we are created that way. We are like a magnet. We go towards things that are shared fictions. And therefore, trying to come at and trying to establish that this is a fact, this is a truth, may be contrary to how biologically we're built.
So I heard that in the opening, a fabulous introduction. And I didn't. I don't know that particular quote, but it didn't go in the direction I thought it would go in. I do believe we are post-truth in the sense maybe that we have some semi-functional societies that seem to be able to operate despite the fact that our politicians don't always work with evidence and our policymakers don't always value truth. I would say that that our being able to organize in large groups is predicated on some faith that we all have access to the same kind of high quality information. So we all hope that everybody else in the city is getting clean water out of the faucets, and we continue to drink that water. Most of us continue to drink that water because we assume we have some faith in the public agencies that organize the supply of clean water. And once in a while, we get jarred loose when it turns out that the water isn't as clean as we expect it to be. But most of us who live in countries with strong governments, whether democracies or authoritarian, have come to expect a basic level of civic services that keep us more or less fed and more or less hydrated and more or less safe. So I'm not sure I agree with that same sense of that same argument that our societies are predicated on storytelling. I do think there's some value to evidence, and the public agencies work best when they work with evidence. In fact, once in a while, you can see examples where a politician who's gone off the rails actually does get tossed out, corrected, and their policies aren't implemented because a technocrat or an engineer or scientist who just understands the logic and the role of evidence doesn't implement the crazy things that a politician might come up with.
In fact, this was a headline today that the former NIH, the outgoing NIH director, basically said that he was being pressured by the former administration to green light, you know, unvetted remedies against COVID-19, and that he resisted.
Yes, I think there's quite a few examples of. I mean, we all valued Fauci for those moments in which he was able to hold the course and be consistent on messaging, and things actually do really fall apart when our technocrats, when the national doctors and the national researchers, when they get muddied in politics. And especially around health messaging, that's what will throw us off, because conflicting messages about which masks, when to do groups, that makes it hard for us to trust that there is a steady hand at the helm. But if the highest ranking medical officer in a country is consistent about their health messaging, then people tend to get vaccinated, they tend to follow the rules, and in the case of COVID, they tend to stay healthy if they don't take on the risks that others will take on.
So I think I want to dig a little deeper into COVID-19 because there's an awful lot of misinformation around there as well. It is not driven necessarily by politics, although maybe there are undertones of it. But as we head into completing our second year of a full-on pandemic, and many of us who have, you know, done as many vaccinations as we possibly can are kind of fed up with the people who aren't getting vaccinated. What are you finding in the realm of, you know, COVID-19 misinformation? Is it similar motivations to the political stuff? Is it different? Or
yeah, that's an interesting question. I'd say it's similar, but can I tell you about some of the things I've learned that makes it interesting, that may be true for politics that I didn't really appreciate before? It turns out that the audience for COVID misinformation is actually quite small. It's really only 10-15% of the population that actively goes after COVID misinformation, that really will spend money on bleach cures and other, you know, other crazy cures. It's a fairly small, the audience for that stuff is quite small.
Thank God.
Yeah, but the challenging part is the much larger group of people who are uncertain or questioning or not quite sure, or may have heard one thing or had a friend or a friend of a friend who actually did get sick with something, had complications from the vaccination. And so the challenge now has become how to communicate well with the people who are confused by what elected leaders are saying, who are a little bit uncertain, and you know, who want to make good decisions, but they don't want to rush out, right, and make the wrong decision. And that's a much larger group of people, especially around vaccination. Figuring out how to reach those people with high quality messages, consistent encouragement, you know, without driving them into the, we don't want to put them in the conspiracy camp and address them as if they're that other type of diehards, but you know, figuring out the balance for that larger group, that's really challenging.
What are you working on now? What kind of research are you working on now?
We have just done a memo on the industry that profits from COVID misinformation. I think one of the things that drives it, just like it's a relatively small audience for this stuff that really consumes the most conspiratorial stuff, there's a fairly small number of people who look out to make money. They're grifters. They want to sell these cures. They want to sell baseball hats, T-shirts. They want you to protest your governor or protest lockdowns, and buy their T-shirts for this stuff. And so they maintain an infrastructure of websites that is conspiratorial, extremist, sensational. And even though Facebook and Google and the various platforms seem to be doing something about COVID anti-vaccination content, they're still providing the infrastructural services for those websites that allows them to take credit cards, to follow somebody, to track somebody from a Facebook group over to a website and direct them with content, you know, to where they're more likely to buy. All that tracker, hosting services, infrastructure services, Amazon, Google, Facebook, they still make money providing those services. It's not a lot of money, but sometimes following the financing of all this helps you see how outsized an impact, right? This really is just a handful of websites.
Yes.
And a significant amount of the content targeted at US social media users, a significant amount of the anti-vax content targeted at US social media users is hosted in Canada and Russia. It's not actually hosted in the US. And so we're trying to figure out how that has come to be and what responsibilities the Canadian government might have. It was upwards of 90% of all the anti-vax, of all the COVID misinformation directed at US citizens is hosted on Cloudflare's servers in Canada.
Leslie's Canadian.
Are you Canadian or did you work with Cloudflare?
I am Canadian, although I'm not living there. I haven't lived there for years. Yeah, so I think that the interesting thing about the internet and mis and disinformation, then there's a couple of things. Is one, social media platforms really supercharge it, right? I mean, it brings it to a scale that is otherwise completely infeasible. But the often overlooked part of it is it also complicates jurisdictions for exactly the reason you just described, which is, you know, you're doing something that may be illegal in the country where people are being affected, but you're not doing it from those countries. And that's that's a challenge that, you know, it's going to take us a while yet to figure out how to address, because we can't just put borders on the internet.
It's a global challenge. And so of the things I'm trying to work on now, I'm trying to figure out how it is that we can respond globally to a global,
right,
the global challenge. If the misinformation is originating in Russia and China, but it's actually hosted in Canada and it's targeted at the US, that's a big complex problem. And, you know, the social media firms have already revealed that they won't respond. They barely respond to the US government when the US government wants things. They don't respond to the Canadian government or the Australian government or the UK government. They will respond in some ways to the European Commission, because the European Commission has fined Google and Microsoft in the past. But the European Commission came up with a voluntary code of conduct. And that's sort of where we still are. Until we figure out what the international demands are going to be, I think it's going to be hard to build the internet that we want, right?
Yeah,
definitely a worthwhile struggle to achieve that. Well, it's been a fascinating discussion today, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.